You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Alan, how are you?
Ruben, very well. Long time no see.
Long time no see. It's
indeed.
It's good to be back.
It's good to be here, yes.
So, what's on the show for today? Organic molecules found on Mars.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. NASA made a big palaver about this, I guess, last week. And, yeah, this is kind of interesting. The question, you know, first posed probably by David Bowie in about 1969, I think, is there life on Mars? No, nothing, people. Come on. Work with me here.
We're too young. Yeah. Or you're too old.
Very possibly.
We're too young.
Yeah. So is there life on Mars? That's the question. So one of, I guess, the telltale signs of life is the presence of organic molecules. Now, your listeners might have a different idea of what the word organic means, possibly, than scientists do. It's not food grown without supposed application of pesticides. It means molecules that are composed primarily of carbon. And such molecules are essentially the building blocks of life. So things like your proteins, your DNAs, your RNAs, all that sort of stuff, they're predominantly made of carbon. So any discovery of molecules that are predominantly carbon-based on other planets is perhaps a pointer to possible life there. So what they found very recently, the good old Curiosity rover, which was blasted off, I guess, about 2011, landed in 2012, and it's still going and performing absolutely brilliantly. So it dug a wee hole in a lake bed and sediments on a lake bed analyzed the material that it got out of this hole by a technique called GCMS, which stands for gas chromatography mass spectrometry. I won't go into the details of that. Suffice it to say that these are extraordinarily delicate instruments, and to actually land one on the surface of another planet and have it work without going wrong for the last 6 years is just utterly, utterly extraordinary. Ask anybody who's used one. They are very, very pernickety instruments, and forever there'll be something not right with them or whatever. So
regardless of actually discovering anything, it's an achievement to get the stuff onto
utterly,
the planet. Yeah,
utterly, utterly remarkable. So the question then becomes, right, we have got definite evidence of these carbon-based molecules. So the next question is, how did they arise? Did they arise biotically? In other words, they are from life forms in the same way that, let's say, oil on planet Earth is from decayed life forms. Or were they formed abiotically? And that could happen from things like carbonate rocks. So there's carbon, obviously, in carbonate rocks. That can get converted to methane through natural processes. And then the methane can act as a starting material for the production of other carbon-based molecules. So that's the question that they now need to answer. Where did these molecules actually come from? And in order to do that, they're going to have to probably send up some more probes or something like that with some more delicate instruments on them.
But am I right in thinking there's already methane gas recorded on Mars?
Yes, indeed. Yes. Yep. That was the other thing that they found as well. They've got methane in the atmosphere, okay? And in order for that to be the case, it's got to be continuously produced, because methane is very, very light, and it'll just basically it won't be held by Mars' gravitational field, and it'll just pop off into outer space. So that then says that there's got to be some source of methane on Mars, and that then points to possibly the methane coming from microbes under the surface. So that would be a decomposition product from them, and it's been found that there's some sort of seasonal variation, so the methane is higher in the summer and lower in the winter, etc., etc., etc. So again, these are all questions that need to be answered, but, you know, fascinating stuff, and hopefully NASA can go cap in hand to good old Donald and, you know, ask for more money to figure this out once and for all.
He's really cut NASA's funding, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think he probably has.
Yeah. I heard that. if it's not by microbes under the surface, the methane production, what else could it be?
Well, that's the thing. So carbonate can go to methane. Very, very deep, apparently. It's got to be very, very deep rocks, but that is known to be able to occur. So You know, that's the big question. And again, the molecules could have come from things like meteorites, comets and stuff that landed on the surface of Mars. And, you know, that's been known because there's similar sort of meteorites and stuff on Earth that have had organic material on them when they landed. So, yeah, kind of nice and worthy of more study, obviously.
Yeah, so, ancient aliens.
And these were 3 billion year old rocks, by the way, as well.
Right.
So that's sort of saying that if it is a remnant of life or whatever, then that's an awfully, awfully long time ago. So remember, the Earth's only about 4.5 billion years old. So
yeah. I don't want us to be the only ones.
We're not. We just haven't met them yet.
Yeah, hopefully. So the next one, a device that can produce water out of thin air. Exciting.
Yeah, this is
maybe.
So these are researchers at Berkeley, and they have come up with a material that can essentially suck water out of the air. Now, when you say out of thin air, now that's sort of saying that, you know, there's no water in the air, isn't it? That's the implication there, isn't it? Yes, there is water in the air. It's just a matter of getting it out. So, you know, in the air all around us, the air that we breathe and everything, there is a decent amount of water. And, you know, the last bloody few days in Auckland, it's been 100%, you know, water in the in the air because it's been pelting down. So there's always some water in the air. It's just a matter of how to get it out. And so one way of doing that would be refrigeration. You can cool things down. You can condense water out of the air, but that requires energy to do that. What they've done is use this thing called a MOF, which is a molecular framework. I'm sorry,
it's like metal organic framework.
Oh, yeah, metal organic framework is a MOF. And now these things have one very remarkable factor, and that's their surface area. So these are just bog standard compounds or whatever, but their surface areas are quite amazing. So 1 gram of a MOF, when you spread it all out, its surface area would cover a rugby field. Wow. 1 gram. Okay, so that's probably less than a teaspoon. And its surface area covers a football field.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's got these extraordinarily high surface areas. And if you can make the surface of the MOF really responsive to water, if you can make it, you know, really attract water, then you've got just such an enormous surface area and such a small amount of material. And so that's what these guys have done at Berkeley. So they've developed this new MOF, this metal organic framework. And what they did was they took about a kilo of it and they stuck it outside in Scottsdale, Arizona, apparently. Yeah. Where the nighttime humidity is about 40% and the daytime humidity is about 8%. So they leave it out in the nighttime. In the daytime, they sort of shut it all up and everything, and it gets warmer and warmer. It expels the water that it's sucked up during the night. And from a kilo of the MOF, they get about 200 mils of water. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot, but it's kind of proof of principle, I guess. Mm. So, you know, at the moment, arid areas of the world use things like desalination plants, which are hugely expensive. So they're basically taking seawater and removing the salt from the seawater. And that's, you know, that's an enormous job. Very, very energy intensive. It's not so bad in the places where they use it, like the Middle East and stuff, because they can use solar power to partially power it at least. This thing doesn't require any power at all. You just sit it out there, and away you go. You know, it just works. So kind of exciting, this.
Yeah, so if we can scale it up,
yes,
it'll be incredible.
Yep.
So what is this going to solve our water crisis then? Or, like, be used to...
Well, as I say, it's certainly proof of principle. And I would imagine there'd be a lot of people very interested in investing in this because, you know, arid areas of the world, you might think the Sahara Desert's got no water in it, but there's still water in the air there, you know. And so if you can access that somehow cheaply, and, you know, this is looking like it's going to be cheap. At the moment, the MOF that they use contains a thing called zirconium, which isn't the cheapest thing in the world. It's not like it's gold or platinum or anything like that. But they're looking at replacing the zirconium with aluminium, which is cheap as chips. So if they can do that, if they can make a MOF containing aluminium, then who knows?
Isn't zirconium the lab-grown diamond?
Yes, indeed. Right. Cubic zirconia. Mm. Absolutely.
Buy that for your fiancé and she won't know.
Yeah, she might.
Although the problem often is it's too perfect, right?
Oh, there's no such thing as too perfect, is it?
We've had a text in. Someone says, "G'day, Professor. I've come to think maybe every planet was like Earth and we hopped from one to the other until we used everything up. Any thoughts on that?"
Oh, that's a theory. I think it might have been a bit sort of hot on Venus and a bit cold on Mars, possibly. And, you know, Earth's the Goldilocks planet. You know, it's just right. We're in the Goldilocks zone, which is actually what they call this in astronomy or whatever. So they're looking for stars out there that contain planets that are in the Goldilocks zone, you know, not too hot, not too cold, just right.
Some people take it as evidence that there is God, that he put us right, just in the right place.
Some people do, yes.
So our next one, Professor Margaret Brimble has become distinguished professor.
Distinguished, yes.
She's become the first New Zealand woman to become a fellow of the Royal Society of London.
Yeah.
Big win for both New Zealand and woman.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, this is really, really big news, and I think it should have been sort of highlighted more in the media than it has been. But so Margaret is a professor here at Auckland, and a distinguished professor, as you say. And she started her training here at Auckland. So she did her undergraduate and her master's here, then did a PhD at Southampton. And then she got an academic position, her first one at Massey, and then went over to Sydney, and now she's back at Auckland. And so she's doing absolutely world-leading work on drug synthesis, basically. So she's an organic chemist. And what that means is that she makes molecules containing mostly carbon, some of which can be used as drugs, and one particular drug is for a syndrome called Rett syndrome, which affects girls around the age of sort of about 18 months, 2 years or something like that, and they it affects their development, and it's a horrible, horrible disease. Apparently there's no known cure for it, but she's developed a drug that looks very, very promising for this. And another drug that stops your brain cells dying after head injuries and things like that. So, you know, this is really, really quite remarkable stuff, and she's done incredible work, and she has been rewarded with that, with a fellowship of the Royal Society, of the Royal Society, with the emphasis on the, because we have a Royal Society of New Zealand, but it's not the Royal Society. So so in terms of fellows of the Royal Society, there have been about 8,000 or so since this was started in the year 1660, and so people like Newton were some of the first sort of fellows of the Royal Society. Women were not admitted until 1945. 1945, yes.
End of World War II. That's
yep, so that was where the first two women were elected fellows of the Royal Society. And since that time, there's been about 150 other women who have been elected fellows of the Royal Society. And apparently, you know, not to drop names, but when I was talking to Richard Dawkins the other day, who himself is a fellow of the Royal Society, you get to sign the book. And the book has the signatures of every member of the Royal Society. Wow. So it's got Rutherford, it's got Newton, it's got Einstein, it's got Stephen Hawking, you know, it's got Darwin, it's got the lot.
Everyone.
So, you know, I think that's that's pretty cool. So I'm sure Margaret will get to make the trip to London at some stage and sign herself into the book. And, you know, this is a really, really, you know, it's a remarkable feat. From a little bit of research that I did this morning, there's about 44 New Zealand-born fellows of the Royal Society, but very, very, very few of them would have done all of their work in New Zealand, all of their research work. So many of them have been trained here and then gone overseas, you know, your Oxbridges or your Yales or wherever. And she's one of the very, very few who's pretty much sort of stayed in New Zealand her entire career and who's done her seminal work in New Zealand. So, you know, good on her, and may there be many more. I think, you know, it's a fabulous, fabulous achievement that really should be celebrated.
So when are you going to get yours?
Yeah, that ain't happening. That ain't happening. And I guess the other big science news was Juliet Gerard being appointed the Prime Minister's Chief Science Advisor. So yes, she's also a Professor of Biochemistry here at Auckland as well. And that was announced yesterday. So, you know, fantastic news all around, really.
Yay for women.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Women and thank science. You very all much good. For being on the show, Alan.
Not a problem, Ruben. Always
great
a pleasure.
To see you again.
Likewise.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.